Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic. If you're on the 51 and you're heading southbound, look out for an accident at Indian School. Valley weather for tonight, we expect partly cloudy skies, lows in the mid to upper 60s. It'll cool off this weekend a bit thanks to some wind. We should be sunny tomorrow with a high of 88, sunny again Sunday with a high of 89. Currently with relative humidity at 9%, it's mostly sunny, 92 degrees at KJZZ.
Arizona Senator John McCain is calling for a criminal investigation by the Justice Department over the Environmental Protection Agency's release of toxic water from an abandoned mine last year. The Senate Indian Affairs Committee held a field hearing in Phoenix today to talk about how the EPA responds to American Indian tribes. KJZZ's Laurel Morales was there, and she joins me. So, Laurel, why did the committee call for this hearing?
Senators John McCain and John Barrasso basically wanted answers from the EPA. Last August, the EPA was checking on an old abandoned gold mine up in Colorado and breached this earthen dam and released 3 million gallons of yellow toxic waste into the Animas and San Juan Rivers. And downstream of all of that is the Navajo Nation, and there are about 1,500 farmers that lost their crops last year, and they've been waiting to plant this year. So planting season has begun, and they've been waiting for the irrigation canal to reopen in their area, but they have kept it closed until this week. And so Navajo President Russell Begay, he testified at this field hearing today. He basically said that the farmers are living in fear.
We're now flushing out the irrigation ditches, and the farmers are afraid because they know that there are contaminants upriver. When the water spikes, when it goes up, when there's a monsoon, we know that those contaminants upriver will flow down onto our land, onto our possibly our farm. So we're going to keep a very close watch on that. We asked for a mobile lab. Mobile lab has not been provided ever.
That was Navajo Nation President Russell Begay. Laurel, what answers did the committee get from the EPA?
So the EPA reminded the Navajo Nation that they've made available $465,000, and that money could be used to pay for a mobile lab, which is what the Navajo Nation has been asking for. President Begay is saying that's not going to be enough money to get the toxicology reports in real time so that they can shut the water off in time for those crops not to be exposed to contaminants. EPA Assistant Administrator Mathy Stanislaus was there at the field hearing, and here's what he has to say about that.
Just recently, we had proposed the listing of a number of mines to restore a long-term restoration of the river. This consists of 48 mines, including the Gold King mines, which collectively discharge 5.5 million gallons a day, every day, continues to this day.
So, Laurel, what questions remain even after today's hearing?
Basically, why hasn't more money been spent? There was continuously a comparison made to Flint, Michigan, where $80 million has been spent on that disaster, and the Navajo Nation has only received a small fraction of that amount.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales. Laurel, thanks.
You're welcome, Mark.
The future of rooftop solar in Arizona could come down to the voters this November. In just the last week or so, two efforts have begun to put regulatory decisions about how residential solar customers get charged on the ballot. And joining me to discuss that is KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, what's brought us to this point where the issue could play out on the ballot instead of through the expected channel, the Corporation Commission?
Indeed, Steve. Usually these regulatory decisions in terms of how you're going to charge customers, that is decided by the state's Public Utilities Commission, the Arizona Corporation Commission. But for years, utilities and the solar industry, particularly the rooftop solar industry, have been at odds over how to integrate customers who are hooked up to the grid but have rooftop solar panels should be charged and what's a fair amount, given the fact that they are producing their own energy, but they're also using the grid. And just this year, the Corporation Commission is hearing a slew of rate cases that really will help determine the future of residential solar in the state. And the pro-solar people, the industry, they got very concerned about some of the new charges that are being proposed by big utilities in the state, and they decided to go to the ballot instead.
And so what are the pro-solar groups saying with their initiative? What's part of it?
The initiative is called, it's a super PAC called Yes on AZ Solar. We're told it's going to consist of a broad coalition, but right now the main financial backer is Solar City. They've donated $3 million. That's a major national rooftop solar leasing company. And essentially they're trying to preserve policies that are favorable to rooftop solar customers, most notably net metering, which essentially reimburses customers with rooftop solar panels for the excess power they produce that generally occurs during midday, and they get a retail rate credit for that. And if that were to go away, many in the solar community, many advocates say that would essentially kill the industry. This would preserve net metering for the next 6 years, and it would also prevent the Corporation Commission from approving demands that the solar advocates claim are discriminatory. It's being led by former regulator Chris Mays, and this is what she had to say.
It's obvious that our utilities are going to try to fight competition. They're going to fight solar, and they're fighting the will of their own consumers and their own customers who clearly want to go solar and want to be free of these efforts to tax them.
And Will, as we alluded to before, we've learned that in response to this campaign to get the solar initiative on the ballot, there may in fact be a competing proposal.
Yes. Just this week, we learned that there's some movement in the legislature to get a referendum on the ballot as well. And that would essentially be a competing proposal to combat some of these policies that are being put forward by the solar initiative. It's being led right now by State Senator Debbie Lesko, and she pretty much says it's unfair that what she calls billionaire out-of-state companies are pushing policies to really privilege them over others. And she goes back to the argument we hear often from utilities, which is that these rooftop solar companies are actually really operating under a subsidy and that they're shifting costs onto other ratepayers. While her proposal is still being drafted, she says it's going to protect all ratepayers and it's going to leave these decisions in the hands of our regulators.
To give an alternative to the voters that protects the vast majority of the ratepayers in Arizona from this egregious initiative that a couple big billionaire companies from out of state are trying to push in our state.
And so I expect we'll learn more about the specifics of this referendum and whether they'll be able to get enough votes to get it on the ballot in the coming weeks.
KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
The broader education scene is changing via innovation and more individually focused learning tracks. But for a lot of people, that change isn't happening quickly enough.
That's a big reason for the dramatic expansion of the ASU-GSV Summit, which brings educators, tech investors, and leaders like Bill Gates and Condoleezza Rice together to meet, negotiate, and discuss big ideas. This year's summit finished earlier this week. The co-founder and CEO of GSV Asset Management, the firm whose name is on the conference, is Michael Moe. Michael, who attends the summit and why are they coming?
This year, there was 3,700 people came to the event, and it's a mix of business leaders, investors, entrepreneurs, educators, government people, philanthropists, and so it's a wide array. But I think what's got everybody motivated is you're seeing, whether it's business leaders that see they can't employ students come out of schools, they can't read, they can't write, they don't have STEM skills, whether it's parents that see this is the first generation of children, there's going to be less educated than themselves. You've got civil rights leaders that say that education is the civil rights issue of our time. And now you have politicians and they're putting their hand up in the air and seeing which way the wind's blowing. They're seeing that for the first time, education is actually an issue that pulls for them. And so against that, you have this entrenched status quo that says, give us more time, give us more money. But this group has come together and said, 200-plus years is long enough. We've got to make change happen today. And that coupled with the innovation that's going on broadly in technology, that this is going at a remarkable pace.
When it comes to a summit like this, is there a situation where you have potential angel investors of these things saying, all right, how much can I increase my investment? How much can I do? And for some people, that's a hard combo when it comes to that and education. But can those work together?
One, investors have different objectives. You know, so there's what's called impact investors, and what they, all they, you know, their focus is on the social mission. The investors that come to the summit are, you know, have a variety of different objectives. It's everything from, as you said, angel investors to, you know, pure venture capitalists, and there's definitely impact investors too. You know, of the 3,700 people, you know, roughly, you know, 350 of them are professional investors. And what I'd say, kind of what is so interesting and important about education from an investment opportunity standpoint, is my personal philosophy is that the education companies that create the, you know, generate the greatest financial returns are the ones that are having the greatest educational impact. So in other words, you know, the education technology businesses that have are able to reach the most students are able to have the greatest effect in terms of people acquiring knowledge, acquiring education, I believe are going to generate the greatest financial return. So you're really aligned. You don't have to give up one for the other, in my view. Again, there's some that would all they care about is the social mission, and there's some that all they care about is the, you know, the financial return.
Seemingly everyone cares about education to some extent or another. Do you think there's a way, whether it's through Silicon Valley innovation or not, to make education almost seem, I'm going to use the word sexy?
Very important question, and there's different pieces to it. So just one, in terms of the sexiness or attractiveness of it, I think what we're seeing clearly is that entrepreneurs and business leaders both are flocking. I mean, the talent and level of interest here is unprecedented. You see, you know, people care about education. They always have cared about education, but I think it's reaching new levels. And part of that is just this reality that we're in a global marketplace, a knowledge-based economy, where education not only makes a difference for how an individual does, but how well a company does, and for that matter, how well a country does.
Michael Moe of GSV Asset Management in Silicon Valley. We've been talking about this week's ASU GSV Summit.
Water flows and machines whir at Tempe's new water testing facility. The 11,000-square-foot building will allow the city to bring its testing in-house as opposed to outsourcing it. David McNeil is Tempe's Environmental Services Manager. So, David, tell me about your new place.
Well, you know, this has really been in the making for about 9 years. It was 9 years ago when we first started having progressive discussions about the fact that our existing facilities were inadequate to serve the purposes that we had for water quality testing and for our laboratory. Ultimately, we were space constrained, and we had certain goals for water quality testing that we couldn't achieve, and we knew that we couldn't achieve going forward with the space and the technology that we had.
So what specifically will you be able to do now that you weren't able to do before?
There's kind of two answers to that question. The first being that regulations for water quality are constantly evolving. The Environmental Protection Agency issues new regulations for new parameters, and additionally, over time, asks us as a drinking water and wastewater utility to see constituents in water at a much higher resolution. So where 20 years ago, we were looking at constituents in water in the parts per million range, new information and new technology is allowing us to see contaminants in water in the parts per trillion and parts per quadrillion range. So having a facility with the technology and the space to evolve into these growing regulations to test more contaminants and to see them at high resolutions, we could only do with a new facility.
In the design of this new facility, did you try as best you can, obviously without a crystal ball, to sort of future-proof against what you might have to be doing down the road and space you might need and technology you might need to acquire?
We did size it for growth. There's really no way to specifically determine what's going to come out at what point, but we did size it for significant growth, knowing that regulations would continue to evolve, technology would continue to evolve, and we had other internal purposes for expanding space and conducting additional tests.
Financially, how will this work out for the city?
Well, this is really, it's not in the end, it's not a financial proposition. Ultimately, we will save money because we've evolved over the last 15 years from doing about 10% of our water quality analysis internally to doing more than 95% of our water quality analysis internally. And this facility will allow us to bring that additional 5% of chemistry in-house. And that does save some money, but, it's not a we didn't do this as a value proposition. We did this because doing testing internally as opposed to contracting it out provides some significant benefits in terms of timeliness, in terms of quality assurance, and in terms of what we can do with that data.
When you were designing this facility and sort of what's inside it, were there other municipalities or other places or other even private facilities that you used as models and said, we want ours to be kind of like this?
We did look at some of the facilities that ASU had and some other laboratories, some of the both public and private laboratories around the valley to kind of gauge the functionality that we desired at first. But in the end, it really came down to the tests that we did and the amount of space we needed to do those tests and what we anticipated in terms of emerging regulations.
David McNeil is the Environmental Services Manager for the City of Tempe. We are talking about the city's new water testing facility. David, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's the show for Friday, April 22nd. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick today, I'm Steve Goldstein. President Obama is in London. He's celebrating Queen Elizabeth II's 90th birthday.
He's also helping Prime Minister David Cameron urge British voters to reject a referendum to leave the European Union.
The U.S. also recognizes that we strengthen our security through our membership in NATO. We strengthen our prosperity through organizations like the G7 and the G20. And I believe the UK strengthens both our collective security and prosperity through the EU.
President Obama speaking at a news conference at 10 Downing Street today. The latest poll averages from The Economist show about 40% of Britons want to leave the European Union. About 51% are in favor of staying. President Obama wrote an op-ed in the Telegraph newspaper telling Britons that leaving would weaken the special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, in Britain, some see President Obama's visit as part of the problem.
I just find it absolutely bizarre that we're being lectured by the Americans about giving up our sovereignty and giving up control when the Americans won't even sign up to the International Convention on the Law of the Sea. They wouldn't dream of sharing sovereignty.
So does he deem
they it? Wouldn't dream of it. It's nakedly hypocritical.
That's the mayor of London, Boris Johnson, in an interview with the BBC last week. Now, for more, we turn to Bernard Jenkin. He's a member of the British Parliament with the Conservative Party. He's also a member of the Vote to Leave Board, which is leading the call to leave the European Union. Mr. Jenkin, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, President Obama said in that op-ed in the Telegraph that I mentioned, essentially, that the United States is facing the same pressures as the UK, like the aftermath of a recession, currency pressures, immigration debates, and that both countries need to resist that impulse to pull back behind walls. What's your response?
Well, this is not the United Kingdom pulling back behind walls. If the United Kingdom leaves the European Union, it means we're going to be an independent country like most countries, like the United States. And it is ironic that some Americans, not all, think the United Kingdom should be absorbed into a Franco-German superstate rather than remain independent. And it's not as though that the European Union is a great success. The Eurozone, or the European single currency, which we're not in but we're associated with, is a disaster. I mean, the Eurozone area, 19 countries share the European single currency. They have 10% unemployment. Where else in the developed world is there 10% unemployment? And we also have a migration crisis, which is sweeping across our continent because the European Union has stupidly opened its borders internally. So once you get into Turkey, once you get into Greece or Italy, you can go anywhere in the European Union. You would never dream of inflicting these things upon yourselves. And the European Union is not like a sort of club of sovereign states. It has a parliament, it has a court, a Supreme Court that can overrule the United Kingdom Parliament. It makes laws that are binding on the member states. And I say to Americans who say that we should stay in the European Union, why don't you join a single currency with Mexico and Canada and Ecuador and Peru and Brazil, why not set them up with a Supreme Court that can overrule your Supreme Court? And why not let them tell you to open your borders to the south and the north to let anybody in who wants to come into your country? Because that's what the Americans are asking us to do.
At the same time, Mr. Jenkins, you know, there is a concern that as the UK deals with the impact of a great recession and terrorism concerns, which are real, and an immigration crisis, which is real, and currency concerns, that politicians like you are responding to populist and even protectionist or xenophobic political impulses.
No, this is complete rubbish. I'm an Atlanticist. I studied European music and European literature at university. My great-grandmother was French, and that is a ridiculous caricature. What we have is a migration crisis and a currency crisis in the European Union caused by the European Union. It's the European Union that swept away all their internal frontiers and made it easy for people to get into the European Union and then move around. It was a former head of Interpol that said that the free travel area in Europe is an invitation for terrorists to come and make their attacks and then make their escape. We found that the Paris attacks and the Belgium attacks recently were terrorists buying weapons in Eastern Europe and traveling around Europe unchecked.
Well, let's talk about the situation now, Mr. Jenkins, because there is a strong argument that a more divided Europe only plays into the hands of Vladimir Putin, who's now seeking to use divisions to attract potential members or leaving members to a closer relationship with Moscow. Now, he's not going to get the UK into an alliance, but other countries see the example. The EU is weakened by this move, and it plays into Putin's hands.
The European Union is not a democracy. It is made up of democracy. It actually takes power away from democracy and gathers itself to a bureaucracy, an unaccountable bureaucracy. That is why we've got the rise of the right in France, in Greece, in Italy. This is not, the European Union is not causing stability. It is causing instability. And that's what I think a lot of people in the United States don't seem to understand. We're not going to be like a United States of Europe in the image of the United States. We've got a much more longer and a much more complicated history. And I don't care what Putin says. I don't care what President Obama says. The British people should make their own judgment in their own national interest. That is what we will do. And I think you will find, by looking after our national interests, that's actually in the United States' national interest too.
Bernard Jenkin is a member of the British Parliament with the Conservative Party. He's also a member of Vote Leave, which wants to leave the European Union. Mr. Jenkins, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway.
Keeping with international news now, this week Brazil's Congress voted to impeach the president, Dilma Rousseff, on charges of corruption. If the Senate also votes to have her impeached next month, then it could spell the end of her presidency if she loses her trial.
Many members of Congress from other parties also face similar or even worse charges, including money laundering, embezzlement, and even keeping people in slavery. So in the midst of all this political mayhem and corruption, what hope is there that Brazil may now be turning a corner? The BBC's Paul Moss reports from the capital, Brasilia.
When I first spoke to the software designer, he was happy to give his name. But then he had second thoughts. And when we met up at a local shopping mall, he explained that life in Brazil can be made very difficult for anyone who spills the beans about corruption. So, speaking anonymously, he told me the story of how he ran a large software company for many years, but then gave it up because the important government contracts they were chasing required compromises that he just wouldn't make.
When you bid for a public contract with Brazilian government, they usually say, what can we do for us to make this project a win-win between all of us? They want you to pay a percentage of the contract for them, which means bribes.
O povo brasileiro merece respeito.
The full extent of corruption in Brazil was laid bare in a recent series of scandals, which climaxed with the president suffering an impeachment vote this week, following rowdy scenes in Congress. The president's party was accused of being corrupt, so too were the vice president and the speaker of the House. In all, more than half the members of Congress are now being investigated, or have actually been charged with illicit financial dealings. So this might seem like an odd time for optimism about corruption in Brazil. But listen to Fabiano Angelico, Brazil's representative for the campaigning organization Transparency International. The scale of the scandal, the number of politicians caught with their hands in the till. It's a sign, he says, that the system is finally working.
The federal police, the federal prosecutors, they share information with other countries. Nowadays, after protests and everything, I believe Brazilian people now is more aware about corruption and they do not accept that anymore.
The Brazilian people are getting a helping hand in that direction. In a basement room below the Congress building, a group of visitors are being shown what's jokingly known as the Hacker's Lab. The lab takes all the information that's publicly available about members of parliament and their financial affairs. And it encourages people to develop programs and apps that will help them detect any dodgy dealings. Hacker's Lab is run by Cristiano Ferri, and it's funded by Congress, thus displaying what Cristiano seems to suggest is a contradictory attitude to tackling corruption.
Brazilian parliament and Brazilian government are very transparent. We have a lot of information available, how the congressmen, the money they spend with telephone, flight tickets, all available online.
Well, then how is it that there is apparently so much corruption in this country that vast amounts of public funds disappear?
We don't have punishment. So we have old school politics. Everyone in Brazil knows how the things are, but we don't have punishment enough.
They're mending the small pier at Lake Paranoa. When life here in the Brazilian capital gets too much, when the frustrations of watching political shenanigans overwhelm, citizens like to wander down to this local beauty spot. But all is not as it should be. The original plan was for an environmentally protected area. Yet now there are hotels, restaurants, and luxury homes that go right down to the water. Some have argued these are illegal. There are cases going through court. But why were they allowed in the first place? One woman sitting by the shore vented her spleen to me.
What bothers me is that the law is not respected because we have to protect at least 5 meters from the lake. We should have trees there, and there aren't any trees here. But politicians wouldn't want to mess with rich and powerful people. Sometimes they may be afraid of those people, and also because they need money for their campaigns. I think things are changing for better. There are honest politicians here. And I have seen justice in Brazil, so I think it's a process. We're not going to make a revolution.
That's the BBC's Paul Moss in Brazil.
In news closer to home, Phoenix officials are looking for alternatives to using Maricopa County jails. Cost is a main consideration. The City Council's Public Safety and Veterans Subcommittee recently took up the issue. Councilman Michael Nowakowski chairs that panel, and he joins me. So, Councilman, how big is this problem of cost the city is trying to deal with?
Basically, every year it goes up, and we need to address that issue, so we're trying to figure out creative ways to reduce that cost and look for alternatives.
When you look at sort of the overall scheme of what the city of Phoenix pays for, how big of a chunk has this become?
You know, every year it's like a 30%, 20% increase. Basically, the booking fee right now, I just got in front of me, is about $306. Every time we book somebody into the county jail, that was an increase from last year by 7.3%. So 31%, I'm sorry. And then we have a daily charge is $90.37. So last year it was at $285. That following year it was $266. In 2013 it was at $251. And in 2012 it was at $236. So you see that we started 5 years ago at $236, and now we're up to $306 just to book somebody into our county jail. So every year it goes up, it goes up, and it goes up. And then the housing, daily housing goes up also.
So what are some of the ways that you might be able to try to reduce that cost, probably not eliminate it? There's going to be some cost to housing prisoners, but how can you try to reduce it?
Well, you know what? The city of Phoenix has already came up with some creative ways. We have expanded video arrangements where we actually have in our South Phoenix precinct where people are arraigned right there at the site. Instead of having them go down to the county jails and get arraigned there, we can have arrangement done within our own jails. So then it cuts the cost of being booked into the county facility. So one of the things that we're looking at is how do you create a night court where the city of Phoenix controls their own night court instead of sending them to the county. The other thing we're looking at is building a facility in North Phoenix so that basically we can avoid police officers driving them all the way into South Phoenix. But myself personally, I believe what we need to start looking at is the private sector. The private sector in helping us look at workforce development, summer youth programs, and business mentor programs where we can actually start to deter individuals in going to jail.
You mentioned some of the options that the city is considering. I'm wondering if setting up a night court or even building a facility in North Phoenix, would that be any less expensive than the way the city is going about things now?
Yes, absolutely. Because then you don't have the booking fees that the county has right now. So then we can actually operate with some, maybe not sworn officers, but individuals that can handle those midnight courts and those other sites that we have. You know, the other thing, too, is in how do we deter people from being booked where maybe it's just an ankle bracelet where individuals can actually be put on home arrest with an ankle bracelet. What that means is that they can still go to work.
Phoenix City Councilman Michael Nowakowski is chair of the Public Safety and Veterans Subcommittee. Councilman Nowakowski, thank you.
No, thank you so much, Mark.
Billions of dollars have been put into cancer research in the U.S., and Arizona has invested considerably in those and related fields. But a recent story in Slate indicates the process behind a lot of cancer research is broken, thanks to a lack of reproducibility of studies and experiments from lab to lab. Daniel Engberg, contributing editor for Slate, wrote the story and joins me. Daniel, how important is reproducibility, and what are the complications surrounding it in cancer and biosciences research?
Findings that seem to be legitimate, seem to be important and useful, and tell us about the body or tell us about disease, they just don't reproduce. When you try to do the same thing again, it turns out that maybe what you thought was true wasn't true. But that's one meaning of reproducibility. It's do the results of your experiments reproduce? Do your findings reproduce? But then there's another meaning, too, which I discovered in the course of researching the story is actually perhaps even more important, and that's the question of whether you can even attempt to do the same experiment at all when a study is completed and a paper is written up and published in an academic journal. Are other people able, just from what you've put out there into the literature, are other people able to try to copy what you did just to test it out for themselves, see if they get the same answer?
Now, is that because the recipe in and of itself isn't being shared fully?
There just aren't really any incentives in the system of, you know, capital S science research in this country to document carefully what it is you're doing. So if you're an academic researcher, you're an assistant professor on a campus somewhere, your career advancement will be determined by how many papers you publish and what quality of papers and what quality of journals and how often those papers are cited. So that favors publishing studies with, you know, splashy, exciting results. The other part of it is a lot of times in research labs, there'll be kind of a lab head, the professor in charge of the whole operation, who's in a kind of managerial position. A lot of the research is done by graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, and those people are more transient. They'll be in the lab for 3 years or 5 years. They'll lead all of the research. They'll often be the ones who write the paper, who take all the notes in their notebooks about what happened, and then the paper is published, and they get their PhD or whatever, and they move on.
Are there potential reforms? Are those even being discussed?
So there's a project called the Reproducibility Project for Cancer Biology. They've taken 50 important cancer biology papers from the last few years, and in a very public way, they're trying to recreate those experiments just to kind of diagnose the problem and figure out, you know, is this, I said a second ago, I called this a crisis. Some other people say it's not a crisis at all. It's an open question. How bad is it? And one of the things that's disturbing in a way is that we don't even know how reliable the research literature is because a lot of the attempts to build on it are kept secret. One of the things they're pushing for is come up with ways to incentivize people to be a little more clear about what they actually did when they publish a study. The journals could demand that authors of these papers include a detailed method section describing, you know, every last thing that they did. Those requirements simply don't exist right now, and they could.
Daniel Engber is a contributing editor for Slate. Dr. Eric Knudsen is the Associate Director for Basic Research at the University of Arizona Cancer Center. And Eric, you think reproducibility is very important, but you don't think the problem Daniel Engber wrote about is at a crisis level?
Reproducibility is key to the scientific method. The biggest successes in science today represent that work, which provides the foundation for the next work, which provides the foundation for hopefully cures in cancer. And so fundamentally, it's completely dependent on reproducibility. That said, I would say there are a lot of mechanisms in place to ensure or enhance reproducibility in science. So I would argue, yes, it is a concern. Yes, it is something to be aware of. But I also think there are a lot of safeguards to protect against it, particularly as developments in the laboratory make their way towards the clinic.
As we try anything in life, the more we do it, the better we are at figuring out what works and what does not. Does that also apply to this sort of complicated research, this idea that there are ways of making sure that we do this better? And is there progress being made on that?
A lot of the work today involves huge volumes of data. And when we go to publish this information, we're not allowed to keep it. We basically have to share it typically through governmental databases where essentially anybody can look at it. And this kind of transparency has been one of the things which I think is really geared towards preventing there from being this view that, oh, the work can't be reproduced.
Is competition a good word, or is it a pejorative in that kind of research?
You know, it's funny, and it really comes down to, I would say, the groups that you're talking about. I mean, in the context of the work we do, and it's about sharing the information pretty much as quickly as you feel confident that, you know, if I'm to say A equals B, I'm pretty sure that A does in fact equal B. And I think, again, in the field of cancer research, there's a lot of emphasis on doing just this, on sharing your data. And quite frankly, you know, no one can be successful holding and hoarding their data because we have to publish it, and part of publishing is making it accessible to everyone else. And so to be a successful scientist, almost by definition, you have to be willing to share your discoveries with others. In that context, I personally think competition is very good because for me, the competition is we want our discoveries to have a positive impact on patients. And so for me, that's what I'm competing for.
Based on what you said, the work is being shared as much as possible. But it does sort of, as a layperson, it sort of brings up the premise of, well, again, you're investing great minds, a lot of money into this. Why wouldn't all these groups work together to some extent?
Yeah, but I would argue that veritably all, you know, major groups, particularly those that want to make an impact on patient outcomes, they have to work together. Is there room for improvement? Sure. I mean, if there were ways, I think, to bring individuals together, and this actually is happening all the time. There are workshops or symposia. There is a bit of a fly in the ointment from this, which is that oftentimes pharmaceutical companies, they're clearly by definition not necessarily going to want to sit down with their competitor and share their information. So I would argue there's a difference in, you know, the kind of the paradigm of delivering cancer care between being in academics and being in pharma. And a lot of that comes down to the bottom line. But the fact of the matter is the funds that go into the public sector, I would say the vast majority of them are being used in pretty collaborative settings to really advance patient outcomes.
Dr. Eric Knudsen, Associate Director for Basic Research at the U of A Cancer Center.
College campuses across the country are dealing with the issue of assault on campus. Northern Arizona University is bringing on more employees in an effort to reduce the number of sexual assaults and to help the victims of those crimes. Melissa Griffin is the Health Promotion Manager at NAU. And Melissa, what's behind this effort?
Sure. Well, I would say first and foremost, the thing that drives the change and the addition of services that we've seen recently is new legislation that was passed a couple of years ago. The Sexual Assault and Violence Elimination Act really highlighted that, universities nationwide need to be paying more attention and spending more resources supporting victims of sexual assault and also helping to prevent sexual assaults on campuses. But beyond that, I would also say that NAU is really a pretty caring place to be as a college student, and we take our students' safety and wellness very seriously.
Has this been a significant problem on the NAU campus relative to other universities of similar size?
No, not at all. In fact, if you look at the numbers in terms of actual reports and then also in terms of self-reports of experiencing sexual assault on surveys and things that we send out to our students, we're right in line with national and state trends. This has really been an issue that has been plaguing universities across the nation for a long, long time. It just so happens that there's been a lot of media attention, and there's been, like I said, some laws that have been put into place that really hold universities more accountable. So it's not that it's a change in how many people are experiencing sexual assault. It's really just a change in how much attention are we paying to a pre-existing issue.
Will the new people who have come on board or will be coming on board be doing more of the same kind of stuff that the university has been doing, maybe just able to do more of it, or will you have them focusing on different kinds of services?
So the new folks that are coming on board really are to supplement what has been happening. We've historically at NAU done a really good job about addressing prevention efforts, trying to prevent sexual assault, educating folks about how to intervene as an active bystander if they see a potential sexual assault. And the new folks that are coming in supplement more sort of the response side of things. So the advocate, that's a shared position with our community partner, victim witness, will be able to meet with folks who have experienced a sexual assault and help them navigate the process, which, you know, for a victim of sexual assault, it can be very daunting.
It sounds like you're trying to build up robust services both on the preventative side, trying to help students figure out how to prevent this sort of thing from happening, what to look for, but also in the unfortunate event that sexual assault does happen, helping those who have been the victims of it to sort of navigate their way through the judicial, the justice system there, and sort of help them get their lives back on track.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, addressing a public health concern like sexual assault really requires a continuum of services all the way from primary prevention to the response and support of victims. So we're trying to, as you said, really, you know, just solidify our robust continuum of services that will hopefully reduce the number of students who experience sexual assault, but then also support those who unfortunately do. And it's kind of interesting as we put more resources and we put more attention on this issue, a success point for us would be if we actually have more reports of sexual assault, which is kind of counterintuitive, but that means that folks know we have resources that can help them, and it might make it a little bit easier for victims of sexual assault to make that report, which can often be a very scary thing to do.
Melissa Griffin is the Health Promotion Manager at NAU. Every time a crime takes place, evidence is collected by police. It could be anything from a fingerprint card to a piece of clothing, anything a suspect might have touched. But where does all of that evidence go? The show's Lauren Gilger takes us to the Phoenix Police Department's massive property room to find out.
So we have a guitar, we have an ATM machine, we have a floor jack, we have a shop vac.
Joe Colbeck is walking up an aisle inside a 60,000 square foot warehouse in South Phoenix.
We have trunks, computers, shopping carts, walkers.
Listing off some of the 1.5 million items stored here.
Welders, carpet samples, bats, TVs, pogo sticks.
Colbeck is the police property supervisor for the Phoenix Police Department, and much of the stuff organized meticulously on these shelves is crime-related.
What's stored here is anything that would be stolen, anything to be used in a crime, any evidence is collected. I mean, there's going to be print cards, there's going to be photographs, there's going to be clothing, radios, cell phones. You name it, we probably have seen it, and we probably even have the kitchen sink.
This has been Colbeck's home since 1988.
21 years old, looking for a career, didn't want to go into service, joined the police department.
Now, 28 years later, he's got the process down to a science.
So when we're scanning property away, it's going to give us a location. It's going to tell us it's in the warehouse, and W means warehouse. It's in the vault. We use V for vault. It's in the freezer. We use F. It's outside with bikes. We'll use a B. Once it's here, the very first thing we do is process our cash and our drugs.
Officers collect all kinds of things from crime scenes, guns, drugs, and cash, an undisclosed amount that's seized from anyone on their way into prison or from a large-scale drug bust.
How much cash do you think you have in this building?
All of it.
And just outside the massive warehouse, there's about 3 acres of land full of stolen cars.
Narcotic seizures, stolen bicycles, motorcycles, engines, go-karts, lawnmowers. This area back here is where we actually break down property. It's going
to be the police get rid of about 200,000 items a year. Some are returned to their owners. They hold an auction every month and donate or destroy the rest. But the property room takes in about 220,000 to 250,000 items a year, too.
There's always going to be some kind of growth.
Then you have other offenses that have no time limitations on them. And so unless you solve the crime, theoretically, it will just stay here. That property will stay here.
Sexual assault kits, which are collected as part of rape investigations, are kept in giant freezers here for 40 years, according to Phoenix Police Sergeant Trent Crump. And evidence from unsolved homicides will never be destroyed. The oldest case still kept in this warehouse is an unsolved murder from 1947.
Just about every type of call that you can think about when you look around in here somehow has evidence or property tied to it. So you could go to a burglary at a house if we started a property crime. And anything that's left behind by a suspect or anything that's touched by a suspect is going to create evidence.
Do you ever sort of get overwhelmed by the amount of stuff in here and how much you have to keep control of?
No, I don't think because after, 28 years of walking in here every day, my primary job is to safeguard it, to manage it, to track it, and get it back to the rightful owner.
It's the show. I'm Lauren Gilger.
Artists are constantly challenging the boundaries of what is possible. One well-known Mexican artist, Tanya Candiani, looked at an iconic piece of the Phoenix desert and saw a giant amplifier. Our producer, Sarah Ventry, spoke with Candiani about a project she's working on called Boom Rock. It involves growing crystals, putting them in the hole in the rock at Papago Park, and allowing artists and musicians to actually play the mountain.
I work a lot with sound. I'm very interested in the mixing or combining or translating codes and language into sound. We were driving towards the university, and then, I saw for the first time the hole in the rock. We call it already the boom rock. And when I saw the hole in the rock, I was like, oh my God, this looks like a natural amplifier. And the first approach was based on growing crystals, like thousands of them, insert them into the stone and play them.
That's incredible. And have you done something like that before, where you've grown crystals and then played them?
Never. That's the interesting part of it. In any process of creating a new work, there's always people which is involved, a specialist. And I just bring this idea and we have to solve it. So every time it's new and we are always learning how to work with the specific ideas and make them happen.
So it sounds almost like there's a component of it that's kind of a collaborative, like it's very kind of abstract and artistic, but it's also scientific, and there are components of that too.
Yes, of course, yeah. Another important thing in my work, which is works between disciplines. For this project also is gonna be interspecies, because actually down the hole in the rock, there's a zoo. So who's the one who's going to be hearing the sounds? The animals.
Oh, wow.
So now the research is going to be about the acoustics in the ears of different species and frequencies that some animals, for example, some kind of birds, some kind of fish, some of the animals have a very special system of hearing. So the musicians, we are going to invite musicians to play the rock, but to play for the animals.
Oh my goodness. I know this is unprecedented. You haven't done this before, but do you have any sort of idea of what it'll sound like when people are actually playing these crystals in the hole in the rock?
No. No, but as soon we start growing the crystals, I mean, I heard once an amplifier made with crystals. We have to tune it for the frequencies.
Oh, wow.
And probably some of those frequencies are going to be not audible for the humans.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, we have this another part of the project, which is constructing a kind of sound sculptures like helmets. So you or me or the audience will be able to put their heads inside these helmets and convert their ears in the ears of the animals and being capable to hear that kind of frequencies.
That's artist Tanya Kandiani talking about her project Boom Rock with the show's Sarah Ventry. Kandiani will start growing the crystals in August, and Boom Rock is to be completed in 2018.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.